Okay, so why don't we go ahead and get started? This is the second lecture of our course on the Austrian business cycle theory, so welcome all of you. Let me just give a few housekeeping notes. First of all, for this week, the office hours are going to be held on Wednesday from noon to 2 p.m. Eastern time. So again, that's this coming Wednesday. I'll have office hours starting at noon and running through 2 p.m. So we're trying to bounce around the timing of the office hours to accommodate as many people as possible. And we think that maybe a lot of you that would fall in your lunch hour, for example, for people in different time zones. So hopefully you can at least tune in to a portion of that. We are going to be taping everything, recording everything, so if you ever miss a lecture or the office hours, don't worry, those things will be available to you. And Grayson maybe can describe in the chat box how you'd go about getting that stuff. But I believe the week one's lecture now is available, but the makeup that we did on Saturday, we recorded for sure using our own equipment, and that's up. And this current lecture will be available later on. I sent everyone an email about this, but let me just reiterate the short essay. If you're taking this class for a grade, remember not only are there the quizzes held every week, but then there's the short essays that occur every 2 weeks. And so since this is week two, that means at the end of this week, not only do you have a quiz that's due, but you got to hand in that short essay. So if you go to that email I sent, the instructions are in there, or if you just go into the Academy website and look at the end now of week two, you'll see a little indicator for, I think it's called essay assignment one or something like that. If you click that, it should be fairly self-explanatory. So just again, don't email me your essay because it's going to get lost. Just upload it directly into the Academy website, and that's the best bet. And it says there's a 1,000-word limit, but that's an upper limit. So you don't have to get 998 words to get full credit on the short essay. All right, we're just putting that in there because I know otherwise some of you are gonna give me a treatise longer than DeSoto's book, which we don't want to grade. Let's see. And also, just to clarify what the different components of your grade and the purpose they serve. The quizzes, the Friday quizzes, those by design are going to be pretty easy. All right, so some of you I think were disappointed that they weren't challenging, but you can't get too tricky with a multiple choice question. They have to be fairly cut and dry so that there's clearly one right answer and the other ones are clearly wrong. So that way nobody gets upset. We don't have to spend a half an hour debating it, and then I have to go give partial credit to people because the question was ambiguous. Right? So that's why those things are designed the way they are. The function of those is just to keep you honest. It's to make sure those of you who want to get a grade, that it sort of nudges you to do the reading every week. Right? So if you do the reading and listen to the lecture, you should be missing at most one or two of those things, and most of you should get them all right every week if you're keeping up with the material. So that's the function of those things. The short essay, won't be really give me periodic feedback to hear things in your guys' words to make sure you're grasping the material. And another function of that is, and I'm sure this is going to happen, I might say something that's confusing, and then that will show up in the short essays, that I'll see 50 people saying something that's not true, and I'll realize I must have said something wrong because you all couldn't have consistently invented this error on your own. And so that sort of thing will happen. So the short essay, by putting it in your own words, makes me hear how you're thinking about it. And so that's going to be a level up in terms of the difficulty from the quizzes. And also, there's more scope there for me to separate the men from the boys, or the women from the girls, if you will. That in a short essay, I can, if I read your 1,000-word essay, up to 1,000-word essay on the Austrian business cycle theory, I'm gonna know who's really well-read Austrian theory and who just understand the basics. So that's where, if you're an advanced student and you're wondering how are you gonna stand apart with these quizzes being so easy, well, partly in the short essay, I'll be able to tell from that. And then also the main chunk of your grade, of course, is the final exam. And so don't worry there. It will really be able to separate the geniuses from the people who are just competent. All right. So the exam at the end will be hard enough so that if you're really an expert, you know, you'll get a better grade than somebody who isn't. All right. So I'm not trying to scare people off or anything. I just want you to understand the way the grading works. So if you do all the readings and keep up and go to the office hours and ask questions, I mean, everybody can get an A in the class. That's possible. But I'm just trying to reassure the people that thought the quizzes were too easy and they might be thinking, oh, this is just going to be, you know, a class that's real simple. No, the quizzes are simple by design. Short essay ones are a little bit harder, and the final exam will be challenging. Okay, let's see, another housekeeping item. I'm going to be out of the country next week. All right, I'm actually going to Haiti. For those of you who read my blog, you know the story behind there. So anyway, not only am I going to be not teaching a class, but I don't even think I'll have internet access. So I'll try to catch up with everything before I leave town. But again, if don't expect to hear from me if you email me next week. Grayson, I think, is going to be available if you have some urgent issue. So what that means is you've got a whole week vacation, in a sense. And what I would recommend is that for those of you who are wanting to do the reading, to try to get ahead, all right? There is a lot of reading. It's possible as we move through the course, some of the DeSoto selections later on in the class, like week 5 or 6, something like there, there's a few weeks there where there's a lot of material. Right now, I'm just going to leave that as it is. But as we go through, I may, before those weeks come up, I might dial that back a little bit to see if we can, reduce the load. But as of right now, I'm not. Those are officially what the assignments are. And in particular, the reading for this week, it's about, I don't know, 45 pages or so from DeSoto. That I'm going to leave that. I mean, I looked at it again. And that's all important stuff. And there wasn't really a section where I could say, yeah, they could skip this and get through it. It really, that's pretty foundational stuff. So what does all that mean? It means, let me put it this way. If you're all eager to do some reading, but you think you might burn out later, this week and next week, make sure you read everything from week 2. Okay, the section on capital is probably the most crucial for where you ought to really do the reading carefully and really try to absorb the subtleties. Okay, to give you a contrast, the part on money, all right, we're going to go deeply into the Austrian understanding of money, where it comes from, and what guides the determination of the purchasing power of money. So we're going to cover all that, and the readings will cover it. But in the grand scheme, if you kind of just coasted through that week, you could still end up understanding Austrian business cycle theory. All right, you don't really need to know the Austrian theory of money to get the gist of Austrian business cycle theory. But on the other hand, if you coasted through this week's material and you thought, oh, I'm really busy, I can't do the DeSoto reading, but I'll catch up later on, and don't do that. All right, it's right now. This is crucial. I'll say this is the most important thing. If you could just look at one week's lecture and reading assignments, I would tell you to do this week's. So again, I'm not trying to tell people to blow off the rest of the class, but my point in saying this week's readings are crucial. So if you're strapped for time, or especially for people who are just auditing, I would highly encourage you, especially since you have a whole week off next week, to do all the readings on capital theory and interest theory that we've assigned in the syllabus for this week. So that includes not only the long selection from DeSoto, but also my Mises daily articles on the various theories of that Bombavrik critiqued. All right, those things, I included them for a reason, and I, as we'll see when I go through the lecture tonight, I really think if you take the time to understand the wrong theory and then to really understand Bombavrik's critique, you will walk away with a much deeper understanding of what Bombavrik's solution is. All right, so it's a little bit, it seems like a waste of time up front. You know, there's a lot of people, especially if I'm teaching to an undergrad class, and you say, okay, let me first tell you the wrong explanation, and let's see why it's wrong, and then I'll tell you the right explanation. A lot of people think, whoa, what are you wasting my time for? Just tell me what the right answer is so I can study that and then go to the bar. And like I say, something as deep and subtle as capital theory in the Austrian tradition, the deeper you go, the more you will understand what happens during the boom and bust cycle. Okay, so again, let me just urge you one last time, make sure I really give it with gusto here. If you're gonna push yourself on 1 week and then you just know you're not gonna be able to keep up the intensity for the whole class, this is the week to do it. Really get hip deep into this stuff. Okay, let's see. Oh, one last housekeeping item. A bunch of you have been sending me email. No, it needs to see the word academy by itself in order for my filter to catch it. So that way, if you do that, they'll stand out to me in my inbox. And for those of you who have already sent me email and I haven't responded, just the way my schedule works, I'm going to catch up on everything on Tuesday. So on Mondays, of course, I'm getting ready for the Monday lecture. And then usually on Wednesday, I'll have office hours. So on Tuesday, this makes sense with my schedule. That's where I come in and just try to go through my inbox and clean that out, and then drop in on your the student discussion groups and so forth. So Tuesday for me is the day when I really spend a lot of time just doing miscellaneous stuff regarding this class. So if you haven't heard from me yet, it's just because on Tuesday I'm gonna try to clean all that stuff out of my inbox. Okay, I think that's all the housekeeping items I had. So why don't we go ahead and move on to the next slide. Outline for the entire lecture tonight. Again, for those who may not have heard this, we altered the format a little bit. Once I did last week's lecture, I realized there's so much material every week that I'm going to need to go longer. So what we're going to do tonight, and this will be the pattern for all future Monday lectures, is I'm going to go till about 15 after or into the second hour. So if it starts at 7 p.m. Eastern, I'm going to go till about 8:15 Eastern with just this formal lecture, and then I'll stop and we'll take a 15-minute break, and then I'll come back, and the remaining hour and a half will be open for your Q&A. So as always, if you have technical issues, obviously, then bring them up right away in the chat room, like if the sound goes out or something like that. But if you have a content question, you want to understand, I'm talking about the abstinence theory and you want to ask me something about that, hold off on that sort of thing until after we come back from the break in the middle of this big window, and then ask me at that point, okay? Because otherwise it's going to interrupt the flow. So let me just go through and get through the hour and 15 minutes, and then I'll come back and answer your questions. And just to warn you, the way that we think it makes sense is when we do start the question and answers, you'll type those into the chat room box, and then Grayson, the TA, is gonna be in charge of feeding me those in a separate chat window, all right? And that way, I'm not fooling around trying to field questions, and he can always have the next one ready and loaded up. And what we'll do is try to platoon it. So, if you have your question answered, he's not gonna post another one of your questions until the other people have their first question answered. Okay, and I think I'm just checking here on the private thing with Grayson to make sure. Okay, so I think I'm all set here. Okay, so I'm gonna now move on, and again, you can download this PowerPoint slide or this entire PowerPoint presentation so you have it locally, so in case you want to move around in the PowerPoint as I'm talking, you can have that ability, and Grayson's posting where you would go to get that in the chat room, or in the chat box. Okay, so capital and interest theory in the Austrian tradition. Now here, I highly recommend that in addition to this particular lecture, you also go and look at my lecture on capital and interest theory that I give at Mises University, and that's available to you in the regular course syllabus. And I'll cover most of the material here, but it'll be coming from a different angle in tonight's lecture. But it really would help you to see it both ways. So first of all, let me just give you some basic definitions. What do we mean by capital goods? And the standard definition, the one you would get in a regular textbook, said they're the produced means of production. Now, let's just break down that definition. So the first part, produced. Well, actually, let's go to the second part first. The phrase means of production. So what does that component of the definition have to do with? Well, they mean as opposed to means of consumption, right? So they're saying these are producer goods, right? These are goods that don't directly satisfy consumer wants. Okay, so an apple directly satisfies hunger, right? Or if you want to have something tasty in your mouth, a lot of people like apples. And so an apple, for most people, most applications, is a consumer good, whereas a tractor typically doesn't provide direct satisfaction, right? The reason most people at least value tractors is because of their the indirect way that they satisfy wants, right? Because you can harvest more agricultural products using a tractor than not having a tractor. And so that's the way that tractors contribute to human welfare. Now, with all of these things, it's not a matter of the physical properties of the item, all right? That whether something is a producer good or a consumer good, that's always a subjective thing. It's in the eye of the beholder. So my son, for example, adores tractors. And if tractors were only $100 a pop, I would buy a tractor and just keep it out in our backyard for him to just look at and climb all over, all right? So, and that would be a toy for him, and it would be a consumer good. But typically, we consider tractors to be capital goods because most humans who use tractors, the way the tractor fits into the person's plan, the way the tractor contributes to that person's satisfaction of his goals or preferences, is that the tractor is a means to some other end that itself is either another producer good or a consumer good. Okay, so that's what we mean here. Definition number one of capital goods, that part of the phrase is the means of production. So all capital goods are means of production, they're not consumer goods. But then that first word, produced, what that refers to is just the fact that it's not nature given, right? That human beings have made these producer goods, and that's what makes them a capital good. Now, as I put down in definition number two there, I say capital goods and then a better definition, meaning this is better than the standard definition, is you take out that word produced and put in reproducible, so that capital goods are reproducible means of production. Now why do we make this sort of anal distinction there? Well, a couple reasons. The main one is that, strictly speaking, in modern subjective value theory, everything should be forward-looking as opposed to backward-looking, right? So when you see a particular item and you're appraising it and you're trying to figure out if this thing is valuable to you, you don't really care where it came from, all right? Its history is irrelevant. What you care about is how can this thing contribute to satisfying my wants in the future, okay? So the fact that a particular item was produced by human beings in the past and that's how it came to be in its current position, that, you know, you could come up with contrived scenarios where maybe that would be relevant, but for the most part, that doesn't matter. What matters is, does this thing, will it contribute to me, to my goal satisfaction in the future? And so the way you distinguish the difference between a natural resource versus a capital good is that the capital goods are reproducible, that if you need to make more of those things, you could, right? So when we're looking at a tractor, when we're trying to figure out how can I incorporate this thing into my plan of action to better satisfy my wants compared to what I would do if I didn't have this tractor, part of your decision-making is guided by the fact that you know there's more where that came from, right? Like the Doritos commercial, eat all you want, we'll make more. It's the same thing with the tractor. We don't have to worry about the fact that, oh man, if we use this tractor and it wears out, it's gone forever. That we know there are more tractors that can be made, right? So that's really the issue. The other, to sort of get you to see the distinction there and why you would run into problems if you used definition number one, is I can give you a silly example. So let's say you're looking at a primitive tribe and they live in the forest and they go out and they hunt and they take sticks and they sharpen them. So they grab a stick, which in and of itself is a natural resource, right? It's just a gift from nature, and they break it off the tree, and then they use rocks or whatever and they sharpen the stick so that it comes to a real fine point, right? And at that point, it's a spear. So they have taken natural resources, the branch from the tree and the rock that was just lying on the ground, and they've combined it with their human labor, and then they produced a capital good, right? It's this spear that is a produced means of production, right? Because they're not gonna eat the spear. They're not gonna use it to scratch their backs, right? Because it's too sharp. So the spear in and of itself doesn't really give direct utility to people, but obviously it helps them hunt. And so that's why it's very valuable to them. So it's a produced means of production. But the problem is, suppose there's some beavers and they get a branch and they start going to town on the thing and eating it and sawing it down, and just some freak coincidence, the people in the tribe are walking by and they scare away the beavers and they look and there is this gift from nature and it's a spear. Right, they pick it up and the thing is just indistinguishable from the capital goods that they know they have produced. All right, now if you were going to cling to definition number one and say that a capital good is a produced means of production, you would have to say that the other nine spears are capital goods because the tribes people made them, whereas that tenth item that they picked up off the ground, oh, that's not a capital good, that's a natural resource because it's a gift from nature, even though for the ends that these people want to put these items, they could be indistinguishable, right? That they could swap that 10th thing for the 4th thing, and it's not like anyone would care one way or the other. They would all say these are equally serviceable, equally useful spears, right? So you see how there, the historical origin of the item is irrelevant. What's important in terms of economic theory, at least, is whether or not something is reproducible, or if all you have to work with is what nature has given you. All right, now, right now, tonight's lecture, I'm not going to get into the implications of that. If you read Murray Rothbard's book, Man, Economy, and State, when he talks about these issues, it has to do with the returns to various activities in long-run equilibrium. All right, but we're not going to get into that. So that's way beyond the scope of what we're talking about tonight. But that's where you would see the difference between a capital good versus a natural resource, and why it matters if something is reproducible. But for tonight, I just want to focus on the fact that the historical traditional definition of capital goods, focusing on whether or not they've been produced, that's incompatible with modern subjective value theory because it's using a backward-looking definition, whereas everything now in modern economics involves people looking forward. Okay, now there's another term that gets thrown around a lot, and that's when people just say the word capital. And the Austrians are pretty good about distinguishing the two. So mainstream economists will tend to talk about capital and capital goods as if those are interchangeable terms. But for the Austrians, when we say capital and we don't qualify it by putting in the word goods after, usually what we have in mind is financial capital. What we mean is it's a monetary calculation. And what it has to do with, it's the monetary value of all the assets dedicated to a particular business enterprise minus the monetary value of all of the business's liabilities. All right, so just to let you see the distinctions there, let's say my buddy's running a laundromat, and I go up to him and I say, hey, Jim, you know, how many, or you got a lot of capital goods invested in your business? Now, of course, real people don't talk like that, but let's just say we're both geeky economists, and I said that to him, and he would say, yeah, I've got a bunch of, you know, big washing machines, and I've got security apparatus on the front door, so the alarm goes off if people break in at night, and I've got the machine that dispenses the individual packets of detergent and the dryer sheets. So yeah, I got a lot of capital goods invested in my business, or that are at my place of residence, at my place of business. A lot of capital goods are on location. And then I say, oh, okay, well, how much capital do you have in your business? Now there, that's not a physical thing, right? And the only way Jim can answer that question is if he's in a society that has a market economy, in a society where there's private ownership and the means of production, and that there are open markets where prices are determined for all of these different capital goods that are in his business. Because when I say to him, how much capital is invested in your business, I'm not talking about the physical things. I don't expect him to say, oh, there's 2,000 pounds worth of capital, meaning he weighed all those machines and they come out, they work out to 2,000 pounds. Or that he's gonna, tell me how much steel is in there. When I say to him, how much capital do you have tied up in your laundromat business, I want him to give me a dollar number. And so again, what he is gonna do is he's gonna add up at least his estimate of what the market value is of the alarm system and the washing machine and the dryer and so forth, and come up with a market estimate of that, and then he's going to subtract the liabilities he has. So if he has a loan on the property or a mortgage or so forth, he might subtract all that out and then tell me at the end, this is how much capital I have invested. And then what he could do is take that number. And because what that does really is it basically is his estimate of, if he wanted to just sell the business and get out of it, how much money could he walk away with? So that's one way of getting across, how much capital do you have invested? And the reason that number would be important is he needs to see what is his earning? What's the interest rate, if you will, the return on his investment? So maybe he's drawing away from the business every year, $10,000 in accounting profit, where he's making $10,000 more from his customers than he's paying out in terms of buying the materials, paying his electric bill, paying the mortgage payment perhaps. And when all is said and done, if he's netting $10,000 a year, not only does he have to worry about the labor he's put into it, but he also needs to say, could I make more if I took my invested financial capital and put it somewhere else? All right, so if he's got $200,000 tied up in that enterprise, where he realizes he just liquidated it, sold everything off, used the proceeds to pay off all of his creditors, and then walked away with whatever was left over, if that number is about $200,000 in his estimation, and he's only making $10,000 a year, in income derived from that business, well, he's probably going to think about doing something else. Okay, because the rate of return on his invested financial capital is pretty low, especially when you also figure out however many hours he needs to put in to keep the place running. Okay, so mainstream economists, like I said, they tend to use these terms interchangeably. They tend to talk about physical capital goods in one breath, and then in the next breath start talking about the rate of return on capital, when there they mean the interest rate, the financial return as a percentage of the principal invested. And those two things are conceptually different, and for mainstream economists they just blur the two together, but the Austrians are very careful about separating physical capital goods from financial capital. Okay, I'm going to spend a lot of tonight talking about the contributions of Bombavrik. So if you remember, if you did the readings for week one, Bombavrik was one of the members of the second generation of the Austrian school. So you have Karl Menger, who was the founder, and as I think it was Schumpeter said in his History of Economic Thought, he said of Menger that Menger was nobody's pupil, he was the epitome of a genius, in the sense that not only was he a really sharp guy, but he was creative. That Menger really just created what we know of as Austrian economics basically out of scratch. Obviously everybody has predecessors, and Menger drew on work of the scholastics and so forth, but for the most part, Menger invented Austrian economics as we know that school today. So Bombavrik was a student of Menger in the sense that, you know, he read Menger's work and absorbed this new approach of subjective price theory or value theory. What Bombavrik did was he took this new insight, this way of explaining market prices, not based on how much labor went into them or based on the cost of production, which is what the classical economists had said, and Menger overturned that. And he said, no, the way we're going to explain market prices is through what we would now call marginal utility theory. All right, Menger didn't use that terminology, but that's what he meant. And so what Bombavrik did, if I had to boil it down in one sentence, is I would say Bombavrik took Menger's insights of subjective marginal price theory and he applied it in an intertemporal context. Okay, so intertemporal meaning across time periods. So Menger explained, you know, why is it that steak has a higher market value than hamburger meat in terms of a pound of steak trades for more money than a pound of hamburger meat. And Menger explained that using subjective marginal utility theory. And Bombavrik explained why present goods have more value than future goods using the same tools. And then he showed that once you understand that, that is what interest is. Okay, and we'll go through that, but I just wanted to upfront let you see the big picture. So that's the essence of what Bombavrik did, was he took subjective marginal utility theory and he applied it to not looking at goods in the same time period, not looking at steak right now versus hamburger meat right now and trying to explain why does steak have a higher price or have a higher market value per pound. Instead, Bombavrik wanted to say, why is it that steak available right now has a higher market value than steak that won't be delivered until next year? Or why does hamburger meat right now have a higher market value than hamburger meat that won't be delivered until next year? All right, and then again, he used Menger's same explanation, but just the goods he was comparing weren't apples now versus oranges now. They were things like present goods now compared to those same goods not available until the future. So make sure you understand that clicks with you, and then what Bombavrik is doing will make a lot more sense. Now, as far as the way he actually went about it, he first of all defined what the interest problem was, and Bombavrik said that it's funny, most people would think that, oh, the interest problem means if I want to go borrow money, why do I have to pay a certain premium on it? You know, why am I charged a fee to borrow money? If I borrow $100 from somebody and then pay him back in 12 months, not only do I have to give the $100 back, but I have to give, whatever, $5 additionally if it's a 5% interest rate on the loan. And that's the way most people today would conceive of the interest problem, and that's not at all what Bombavrik did. Bombavrik, right from the beginning, when he wanted to figure out, you know, what's the essence of the interest problem, he didn't look at the loan market. He looked at the production market. He looked at what happens when entrepreneurs go into the markets for labor and other resources and capital goods, and they buy inputs. They buy things that are going to be used to create goods down the road. And Bombavrik wanted to know, why is it that there's this apparent undervaluation of the factors of production? All right, and the reason let me just talk you through, and I'm going to have to speed it up a little bit here because there's so much material to get over tonight, but this part I dwell on more in the Mises University lecture on capital and interest if you want to look at that later on. But very briefly for our purposes here, just think about it this way. What happens, well, let me back up. Make sure you realize that interest is not just something that happens in the loan market. So if you lend someone $100 today and charge them a 5% interest rate and they give you $105 back next year, well, that's obviously interest. That's $5 of interest or 5%. But the point you have to realize is that that return where invested financial capital tends to grow over time, that doesn't just happen in the loan market. That happens in all markets that have a time lag built into them. So if I'm in business and I have $1,000 of financial capital, I can go and hire workers and buy other materials that collectively cost me $1,000. So I spend $1,000 hiring workers, buying raw materials, and so forth, and then they work on something and produce a good that I then sell 1 year later, right? Because it takes them a year working on the materials to fashion this thing, and then 1 year later I go and sell the good, and maybe I sell it for $1,000 and $1,050, okay? So there, I've also made a 5% return. And so Bombaber was seeing that interest actually pervades all markets. It's not just in the contractual loan market. And so what Bombaber wanted to know is, he said, why is it the case that entrepreneurs don't bid up the prices of the inputs? Right? Because just think about that for a minute. It's typically the case, I mean, there's exceptions where people lose money, but generally speaking, firms are able to make what we would now call an accounting profit, right? The firms typically, in the normal course of business, are able to sell their final goods to their customers for more total revenue than the total amount of monetary expenses that the firms had to outlay in order to buy all the factors that went into making the thing. All right, so Mbabra wanted to know, why is that the case? Wouldn't you expect over time that, you know, seeing that gap, seeing the fact that there's this markup, if you will, why doesn't competition make some firms bid up the prices of those inputs until that gap disappears? So that if you know you're going to be able to sell the output good for $1,050, how come the inputs don't get bid up in price until the point where collectively they cost $1,050, so that there's no more markup, right? So that's the interest problem for Bombaver, and you can see why he viewed it as an apparent undervaluation of the factors of production. It seemed like entrepreneurs weren't bidding them up to their full value. Okay, now moving on, another part of Bombaver's contributions is he, you know, defines that problem, and then he went through in his first book and just eviscerates, just completely destroys all these other theories. So he makes this huge taxonomy, and he just catalogs all the other theories that were in existence until the time he was writing. And he just goes through and catalogs them all and just blows them all up. I mean, it's a tour de force. I mean, really, if you've read Human Action and you see how Mises will take somebody he disagrees with and blow the guy up, I mean, you need to realize that Mises, I think, was influenced very heavily by Bombaber in terms of just that style. I mean, I'm sure maybe it's a German thing, but Bombaber really is more Mises than Mises is in that respect. All right, and so you should really just go, if you have the time, go look at some of those critiques in the original, well, not the original German, in the English translation of the original, just to see how masterful they are. So I gave you a little bit of a taste in those three Mises Daily articles, but again, if you really want to see it in its full glory, go look at the actual original, or at least the English translation. But for right now, let me go through and give you the highlights of these things. So the exploitation theory, this was the standard Marxist explanation, and here the idea was this. They said, look, it's useful for you, again, to read these things, because getting inside the head of the person who's advancing the erroneous theory and then seeing how Bombaver blows that up, you will walk away with a much crisper understanding of what the right theory needs to look like. Okay, so again, these aren't just interesting, fun little excursions. I mean, you will understand correct Austrian capital theory a lot better if you go through and put the time into at least read those daily articles that we put in the syllabus. So the exploitation theory, where the Marxists are coming from, is they say, look, in a modern capitalist economy, you've got this class of people called the capitalists, and what do? They don't lift a finger. They contribute absolutely nothing to the production process, right? That every year, if we looked around and kept track of how much food everybody ate, let's just say that food was the main thing being produced, you would see that there were some people that were the farmers, right? And they would grow the crops and they would harvest them and so on. And then other people might drive the trucks that bring the food to market, and other people would be in the grocery store working, you know, stocking the shelves and so forth. And yet, and so that would explain why all those people get to eat, right? Because they're contributing. They play a part in the production of the food, so it only makes sense that they also get to eat some of that. But then there would be this class of people called the capitalists, and they also get to eat every year. In fact, they get to eat quite well. A lot of them are overweight, right? And so then the question is, well, what are they contributing? And the Marxists say they're not contributing anything, right? That if you looked at mechanically, physically, who is actually making all of this food, it's obviously the workers with their labor power mixed with the gifts of nature. And nature gives her gifts for free. And so, nature doesn't need to eat, as it were. Right, so clearly, to the Marxist, it seems the only way capitalists can earn an interest income, that they can earn dividends from their financial capital, and then use that money to go to the store and buy food and other real goods, is if they're skimming off the top, right? That the workers, with their labor combined with the gifts of nature, are producing this certain amount of output every year, and to the extent that the capitalists get to consume it all, they're just skimming off what the workers have produced, and so therefore, the workers end up with less than what they actually produced. So the Marxist motto is that the workers ought to get paid the full product of their labor, and the Marxists think that they're necessarily not getting paid the full product, because you've got this parasitic class of capitalists who get to consume year after year, even though they're not contributing to the output. All right, so if you go to the Daily Article, you'll see Bombauer blows that theory up three different ways. But let me just focus on one way right now, is he points out that, look at what the worker is entitled to. So let me put it this way. Bombauer agrees. He says, yes, the worker is entitled to the full value of his product. All right, so Bombauer agrees with the Marxist slogan, but he says you're leaving out the time element, that the worker who, let's say, goes to a factory and processes some material that a year from now is going to come out as a car, a finished car, that worker who does something a year in advance, he is entitled to his share of the final output, but we have to keep in mind the time element. And so Bombauer says the worker is entitled either right now to the full value of what he has produced right now, its current value, or if you want to say, no, I want the worker to get his fair share of the value of the output good when it's actually available and sold to consumers, then that's fine, but the worker then can only get that quota of his value at the time of final sale. Okay, and Bombauer says what the Marxists are doing is they want something that's not just. They want the worker right now to get his share of the full value of the eventual product valued at its future price, not at its current price. All right, so that's the essential flaw in what the exploitation theory. It's overlooking the fact that when workers go to the factory, let's say, and they labor, and then they get paid from the capitalists, and they go to the store and buy food, think about what's happened there. The worker is getting, in a sense, in advance. Okay, when the worker gets paid, he can go consume present goods right away, even though his labor may not yield tangible results for consumers until years in the future. So if you think about a site where we're building a house, right? And in the beginning, they come in, they bring in the heavy equipment, and they dig a big hole, lay the foundation, and so on. Well, after the first week of work, and the workers have built the hole or dug out the hole and lay the foundation and so on, they get their paycheck, and they go and they start buying stuff, right? They go to the store, they get food, they take their wife out to the movie, they can take her out to dinner, what have you. They're getting to enjoy consumption right now, even though if you ask them, well, what did you produce this week? All they can do is point to a hole in the ground, and that hole in and of itself is useless, right? That hole's not giving utility to anybody. What it is doing, though, is it's the first step along the way to building a finished house, which down the road will then be sold for a lot of money to consumers. But the point is, the workers are getting an advance from the capitalists, and Bobarik says that's the reason that there's this so-called gap, or this skimming off the top really isn't skimming off the top once you take into account the time element. Okay, the next one is the abstinence theory. Now here, again, I'm going to have to be brief here because we're burning through the minutes and I need to deal with so much more later on. But the abstinence theory has to do with, and again, this is a very compelling theory when you first think about it. And in particular, it's very close to Mubarak's own explanation. And so you might just lump the two together and say that, oh, basically, the abstinence theorists are saying the same thing. And in fact, I've seen a lot of people explain the Austrian theory in sort of loose colloquial terms, and they'll actually give the abstinence theory, which we'll see is that isn't right. Okay, so what the abstinence theory says is that there's a missing component, that when you want to figure out, you know, why is it that there's this apparent undervaluation? If you look at the labor that's purchased, and you look at the steel and the other resources, and they add up to $1,000, and yet you can then a year later sell the finished good for $1,050, you say, man, why are there this undervaluation to the tune of $50 that allows for this markup and this apparent interest return? The abstinence theorist says, oh, because actually you're leaving out one of the inputs. See, what's going on is you're buying the labor and the steel and the rubber and all the other resources, and you're buying $50 worth of abstinence, because the capitalist who has to invest the $1,000, he's out of that money. He doesn't have access to it for a full year. He has to wait a year. He has to abstain from consumption for a full year before he gets his money back. And so that's where that $50 comes in, is because in addition to all of the other outlays, you have to buy the abstinence of the capitalist, and that explains the apparent undervaluation. So Bombabrick says, no, that's not right, that involves a double counting, that you're not on top of all of the other resources that you're devoting to a particular project, you're not also devoting this psychic quality called abstinence, and that's another input that's going into it. He says that's fundamentally misconceived. What happens, and I don't have time to go over it right now, but it's extremely clever the way Bombabrick really drives home the point, that he states what the correct analysis is, and you say, okay, that makes sense, but yet it still seems like the abstinence theory is basically right, and then he just goes through and gives an example and just blows it out of the water. And so specifically what he does is he says, okay, let's say there's a guy and he's choosing, how does he want to use his day of labor, right? That he could just take the day off and relax on the beach. That's one use of his body's abilities for a day, right? And so that's got a certain amount of utility. Or he could go and let's say pick some apples and have 10 apples at the end of the day. Or he can take some seeds and spend all day planting them and fertilizing them and watering them so that 10 years from now, a new tree has grown up and then he has 100 apples. Okay, and so in a sense, the way these things work, if you got into the literature, the problem would be to say, why is it that a day's worth of labor trades for 10 apples in the present, right? Because you could spend a day collecting the apples. But a day's worth of labor also exchanges for 100 apples 10 years from now, right? And so that would be the explanation. And so you would wonder, why does it seem like there's this, you know, excess return in measured in terms of apples if you're willing to wait 10 years? And the abstinence theorist would say, oh, it's because, you know, you have to compensate the guy for having to wait for 10 years. And that's why you need to, you know, pay him more, because he has this anguish of inputting not only his day of labor and giving up the leisure, but also on top of that, you're asking him to wait for 10 years. And so that's another cost that goes into it, and that's why he needs to be paid more to compensate for that. So Mubarak says that's wrong, that the cost in both cases is the value he places on the leisure. Whether he devotes his day to collecting 10 apples, so he has 10 apples right now to show for it, or whether he takes his day and instead of going to the beach, instead he labors all day planting seeds, fertilizing and watering them, so that 10 years from now he knows he's going to get 100 apples. In both cases, he says, the cost is the value he places on spending the day at the beach. That's what he's given up in order to get either of those goods, either the 10 apples right now or the likelihood of getting 100 apples 10 years from now. And Bombabrick says the way to really drive home the point is, let's say a storm comes and destroys, you know, all of his work when he plants the seeds, and the storm comes and disrupts it so that now his work is totally destroyed. And if we ask, okay, what was the cost to him of doing, of planting all that? Again, you would say, oh, it was the value he places on a day at the beach. You wouldn't say, oh, the cost now because that storm hit was the value of his leisure that he could have had at the beach, plus now an infinite amount of waiting because he's never going to see those apples. No, you wouldn't say that at all. You would know that that project's done with, and what he lost was the labor he spent planting those seeds when he should have just gone to the beach since the storm was going to come and destroy them. Okay, so if you haven't done the reading yet, I know this is going to seem a little bit difficult, and that's why, again, I encourage you to at least try the readings beforehand, because I'm hoping many of you read those articles, and now that I'm talking about it, you're really getting the point, whereas if you haven't looked at them yet, this is understandably going to be a little bit opaque, and hopefully it'll make a lot more sense when you go and read it. Okay, so the naive productivity theory, now this is the one that's really important for modern Austrians. The naive productivity theory, the way it explained interest, is it said, okay, the reason somebody with money right now can go out and buy a bunch of inputs and then make a product that ends up being sold for more money than they originally pumped into the project, the reason you get this excess return is that capital is productive, right? And so they say that's where it's coming from, that you buy certain types of capital goods and they're productive and you can produce more with them than without them. And so, you know, what's the mystery here? It makes sense that if you buy $1,000 worth of materials and machines and so forth, that it will create, let's say, $1,050 worth of output, and that you have that $50 excess return because capital is productive. And this, incidentally, if you go to grad school, is that's what a mainstream economist is going to say. They're going to say interest is due to the marginal product of capital, just like they're going to say wages are due to the marginal product of labor. That if you're doing it mathematically, you'd say take the derivative of the production function with respect to labor, and that's the wage rate in equilibrium. And they say by the same token, if you're doing a mathematical model and you want to know what's the interest rate in this world, in this little hypothetical model, they take the production function, they take the derivative with respect to K, which stands for capital, and out pops the equilibrium interest rate. All right, so incidentally, if you have no clue what I'm talking about, don't panic. You're not going to be tested on that. I'm just trying to relate to many of you who are going to grad school, so you understand that the naive productivity theory, in words, back in the late 1800s, was basically the same theory that has now been codified in terms of mathematical economics. All right, which is good to know since Bombaverick blew it up. Right, and so you see that's why mainstream economists go awry, according to the Austrians. Now, incidentally, and this was part of my dissertation, it took me a while to figure out what was going on. The math is correct. If you go to a grad school and you study the mathematical models, the math is correct, right? So you wonder, so in other words, the interest rate in their models really does equal the marginal product of capital, right? So they don't make a mistake in their reasoning. But at the same time, Bombaverick's verbal logic is also correct, all right? And so I'm not going to right now in this lecture get into the resolution. I talk about it in the Mises Daily article if you're curious, okay? But I just want to point out, don't walk away from this thinking that, oh, Dr. Murphy just said the mainstream economists' models are stupid. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is the mainstream economists misunderstand what their mathematical models are doing. And if a mainstream economist read Bombaverick's verbal logic, he would think Bombaverick made a mistake, but Bombaverick didn't make a mistake. It has to do with the assumptions they make in those mathematical models, sort of, it rules out the problem that Bombaverick's worrying about. So in other words, the mainstream models assume away the problem, and then they say, hey, there is no problem. And they think that they've proved something impressive when, no, they just assumed it from the outset. Okay, so that's kind of what's going on here, but just be careful. Don't tell a mainstream economist that your theory is stupid because of what Bombaverick said. Just make sure that in their own little world, they're correct. It's just when they then try to talk about it in plain English, then usually they say things that are wrong because they generalize and deviate from the narrow conditions in their model. Okay, so how does Bombaverick deal with the naive productivity theory. He says, look, you're dodging the issue. The fact that capital goods are productive explains why they have prices. So yeah, if you're a farmer and you have some money and you say, okay, what if I don't spend this money, if I just use my bare hands, I can pick a certain amount of tomatoes and sell them every year. You say, okay, but look, if I go and take my money and go buy $1,000 tractor and then use the tractor in my agricultural operations, I can then harvest and sell not only the same amount of tomatoes as before with my bare labor, but also $1,050 more of tomatoes, so that it seems like the tractor more than pays for itself, right? And that's where, and so to explain that, the naive productivity theorist says, oh, it's because the tractor is productive. And Bombaverick wants to say, you're missing the point. Yes, the tractor is productive, and that's why the farmer has to pay a price for it. And so the question is, how come the tractor's price only gets bid up to some fraction of what it's ultimately going to contribute to your output? In other words, if the tractor ultimately, let me put it this way, if the farmer with his bare hands harvests $100 worth of tomatoes, but then with the tractor, every year he's able to sell $1,150 worth of tomatoes, well then you would think that, oh, it looks like the tractor's contributing $1,050 worth of output, which in a sense it is. And so then the question Bombaverick says is, why doesn't the price of a tractor that the manufacturer charges get bid up to $1,050? If it only gets bid up to $1,000, then the farmer, by investing in the tractor, not only it pays for its purchase price, but he has an extra $50 left over. So in other words, the farmer, his financial capital grows year after year if he keeps rolling it over in tractors. And so Bombaverick wants to say that that doesn't make any sense just by pointing to the productivity of tractors per se. Okay, so that's what the naive productivity theory is and Bombaverick's refutation of it. Okay, so now that you've seen Bombaverick's, the way he defines the problem and then how he refutes other explanations to this problem, what's his solution? Well, very simply, what we've got here is part A, is that present goods are valued more than equivalent future goods. All right, so that part about equivalent, I think Bombaverick's exact wording, at least in the English translation, was something like, present goods are valued more than future goods of like kind and quantity. Okay, so obviously, you might prefer to have 2,000 ounces of gold delivered in 1 year as opposed to 1 ounce of gold today. But that wouldn't be a violation of this rule because 2,000 ounces of gold is better than 1 ounce of gold, right? So it has to be, you have to be comparing the same number of goods, same number of units, and also they have to be of comparable quality. So if you say to me, hey, do you want a hamburger now or a hamburger a year from now, but then I realize that what you mean is the present hamburger is going to be real ratty and it's falling apart and there's fleas crawling all over it and everything, or the hamburger a year from now is going to be this deluxe burger from a very fancy restaurant, I might very plausibly say I'd rather have that future hamburger. But again, that wouldn't be a violation of this rule, that when we say present goods are valued more than equivalent future goods, we're trying to hold those other things equal and say if the only real difference between the two is the date of availability, well then people tend to prefer the goods that are sooner, that are going to come to you sooner rather than later. Okay, now I'm not going to have time to get into it right now because I want to wrap this thing up in about 14 minutes. If you go to the Mises University lecture there, I elaborate on a little bit more, and also of course in the reading material. But very briefly here, just think through that alone, once you grasp that, if you just accept for the sake of argument that this is true, that people subjectively value present goods more than future goods, well then we've explained the interest problem, right? That there is no undervaluation of inputs. What's happening is when people right now use their financial capital and they buy inputs, when they buy capital goods, natural resources, and labor, and they combine them into something that's going to yield a consumer good in the future, what they're doing, one way of thinking about it, is to say that right now it's like they're buying a claim on a future good. right? So if you buy all the materials that you need in order to have a finished house 1 year from now, then Bobrick wants to say economically what you're doing is you're buying a claim on a future house. And so if I already know, independent from that, if you just tell me that there's a general rule that if I walk up to somebody and say, hey, do you want a house right now, or do you want me to give you an airtight claim on a house that won't be delivered to you until 12 months from now? Well, to say present goods are more valuable than future goods means people are going to say, give me the house right now, all right? And if you think about it even further, if you asked how much would people pay for those two things, you'd say, okay, how much would you pay for this particular house right now? And maybe someone says, I'd pay you $100,000 for that. Say, okay, so that the house right now has a market price of $100,000. And then instead I show you an airtight legal claim that says, you know, the bearer of this note will have delivered to him in 12 months a house of such and such characteristics, and it's describing the exact same house that we just talked about. And I say, how much would you pay me for this claim, this piece of paper? You might say, oh, I'd pay you $98,000 for that. All right? You wouldn't pay $100,000 because you'd only pay $100,000 for the house right now. So you have to pay less than that for just getting the claim on that same house that won't be available for another year. Okay, so if you understand that and just accept that, at least for the sake of argument, that people would pay more for something to be delivered immediately rather than just have an airtight claim on the thing to be delivered in the future, well, then the interest problem falls away, because then an entrepreneur, you know, a builder who has financial capital and he wants to go and clear a site and buy all the materials and build a house, and it takes him a year to do it, when he invests that money up front, let's say he invests $98,000 in all of the materials. You know, he has to hire the workers, he has to buy the cement, he has to buy the bricks and so forth, have the backhoes come in and dig out the land and so forth. And he invests $98,000 in that project, and then it gets constructed over the course of a year, and then he sells it for $100,000 12 months from now. There's nothing mysterious about it, because when he invested his money up front, at that point the house wasn't ready yet. It was a prospective house. It was a future house. And we already know that right now the price of a house that won't be delivered for 12 months, it's not $100,000, it's only $98,000. Okay, so that's the solution. All right, now going on to part B, Bumbauer didn't just stop there, okay? He then gave three separate causes of why it should be the case that people value present goods more than future goods. All right, so now this, I don't want to get too much into this. If you're real nerdy and you care, you can go Google my doctoral dissertation where I got into this stuff. But I'm not even going to give you the link for that, because I don't want to encourage people to do that, because that's really far beyond what you need to do for this class. But just so you know, if you go and read, well, I'll move to the next slide. But let me just, and I'll come back to this point then. But for here, let me just again clarify, Bumbauerk did not give four different reasons for interest. Okay, Bumbauerk's explanation of the interest problem was present goods are valued more than future goods, period. Okay, that's the solution to the interest problem. That's what explains this apparent undervaluation of inputs. But then he said, now why should it be the case that there is this premium placed on present goods? And then he gave three separate reasons for that. All right, so that's the way to understand what Bumbauerk is doing, and I think a lot of subsequent Austrians misunderstood the subtleties of his explanation. Okay, so the evolution of Bumbauerk's theory in the Austrian tradition. First of all, Frank Fetter came along and he said, look, it's just due to time preference, end of story. And this goes back to what I was saying there a minute ago. And you don't need to know this for this class, but you need to know this in case you go and read Human Action or Fetter and you want to understand what they're talking about. Bumbauerk gave his story about present goods being more valuable than future goods and showed how that explained the interest problem. But then when he tried to explain the causes for that, one of the reasons Bumbauerk said that present goods are more valuable than future goods is what Bumbauerk called the superior technical productivity of present goods. And this, in the next slide, we'll get to this. Basically, it had to do with the fact that Bumbauerk said roundabout production processes are more physically productive. And that's why Bombavrick said, you know, you always would rather get a factor of production sooner rather than later, because the sooner you get it, you can go ahead and get it into a production process, and then the longer it's rolling over, right? So if somebody says to me, hey, do you want, a certain amount of iron ore, do you want it now or do you want it 5 years from now? I say, give it to me now, because that means I have 5 more years that it can be in a production process, as compared to the case if you just give me the ore 5 years from now. And so why do I care about that? Well, if it's the case, just empirically, if it's the case that the longer resources are tied up in a process, the more physically productive it is, well, then obviously I'm going to have more output. The earlier you give me those production goods, the more output I'm going to get, because I can have it rolling over for longer. Okay, so that's the idea. So Fetter said that he didn't like what Bombavrick did, because Fetter thought Bombavrick was sneaking in a productivity explanation through the back door. And Fetter was sort of mystified, and he said, you know, Bombavrick was a genius. He blew up the naive productivity theory and showed us that interest has nothing to do with the productivity of capitalistic processes. Didn't Bombavrick, you know, prove that was a complete non sequitur? And Bombavrick showed us that it had to do with the fact that present goods are more valuable than future goods. And so Fetter said that's the explanation, you know, full stop. And it doesn't matter whether capital goods, you know, their physical productivity is irrelevant. That just explains the prices of the capital goods. It has nothing to do with the excess return you seem to get if you use capital goods in a process. You know, why does it seem to be the case that you get more from the output than the amount of money you had to spend on the capital good? Fetter wants to say that is due to time preference. End of story, and that Bombavrick is wrong and sort of, you know, having one of his components of his explanation refer to capitalistic productivity. Okay, so again, this is really, really subtle stuff here. If you're getting lost, don't panic, but I do want to, for the record, explain this stuff, since this was my dissertation and I'm, you know, fairly knowledgeable in this area. But if you're getting lost in these particular details, don't freak out. You know, what you need to know is Bombavrick's critique of those other theories, and then why his own, the explanation of time preference, why that solves the problem. Those are the important things. Here I'm just sort of giving you the history of thought. So now Ludwig von Mises, what happened with him? He liked what Fetter had done, that Mises agreed that Bombavrick was just gorgeous in setting up the interest problem and blowing up all the other theories, and in particular showing the flaw in the naive productivity explanation. Mises thought all that was wonderful, but he thought that Fetter had crystallized the theory better. That Fetter, in other words, Mises thought, had sort of separated the wheat from the chaff, and that was good. The one thing that Mises did is that he took Fetter's theory and made it a priori. So if you look at Fetter's work, Fetter says, look, interest is due, has nothing to do with capital productivity. It has to do with time preference, the fact that people value present goods more than future goods. But that the fact of time preference is just an empirical thing, right? It just happens to be the case that if you look out in the world, you see people value present goods more than future goods, according to Fetter. And he referred to psychology and things like that. He said, look, people are mortal, and if you tried to postpone all your consumption until you were 100 years old, you would die before you reached that age. And so Fetter tried to give sort of biological or psychological explanations for why people had time preference, whereas Mises said, yes, all that stuff is true, but time preference in the Misesian framework is a priori true. It is a fact of action, right? I'm just going to give you one of his arguments right now. Mises says, look, even if we imagine a being who is immortal, okay, and you know, there's no question of the fact that this being could postpone consumption if he wanted to. It's not that he would starve to death or that there was some other technological, physical limitation requiring him to consume now as opposed to waiting. Mises says, even if we assume all that away, nonetheless, to say that this being has a goal, has some preference, means that he must prefer to achieve it sooner rather than later. But there must be that time preference built into the very nature of of goal-seeking action. And the way Mises gets that across is he says, because look it, suppose you're faced, this immortal being is faced with a choice between consuming an apple today or an apple tomorrow. If we don't have built in this preference for consuming the apple today, if the being could say, I don't care, I'll consume the apple tomorrow, well, then Mises says, okay, let's hold everything else equal. Let's let one day pass, and now the being is faced with the same choice. Say, hey, do you want to consume the apple now or tomorrow? And if the being says, it makes no difference to me, I can wait, then you realize that you could just keep doing that day after day, again, holding everything else equal, and then the being would never get to consume that apple. Right? So that's where Mises is coming from when he says the very nature of action, what it means to say something is a good, necessarily, just thinking through the logic of it, means there must be this built-in tendency, other things equal, for you to want to consume it sooner rather than later. Okay, so you see just the way Mises thinks about that, right? It has nothing to do with the fact that you're hungry or that you'll die from starvation and then never get to eat the apple. He's saying that's not relevant, that even if we're just picturing the pure logic of action itself, it's sort of, you know, one of the implications pops out is the fact that present goods are more valuable than future goods, holding everything else equal. Okay, so again, Mises thought time preference explained interest in the market, that it has nothing to do with capital productivity, and he credits Bumbavrk for that insight. And then Mises says, on top of that, this time preference isn't just some empirical regularity, it is a necessary feature of action itself. Okay, I'm going to have to wrap it up. I'm going to go a little bit over here just because we had so much material, but then we will still get a full 15-minute break for those of you whose bladders are about to explode. More Bumbavrk. Okay, sometimes I think it's a fun experiment to try to figure out, you know, who is the better, more brilliant economist, Mises or Bumbavrk, because Mises had probably more arrows in his quiver, or feathers in his cap, if you will, that I think Mises just contributed on so many different areas. But where Bumbavrk contributed, I mean, it's such a deep thing that he almost created out of nothing. It's really impressive. All right. So in addition to his formulation of the interest problem, Bumbavrk also really is, he took Mengerian capital theory and really extended it and elaborated on it. So very briefly, you know, where's Bumbavrk coming from? He wants to say that more roundabout processes are more capitalistic, and the longer resources are invested, the more productive the process can be. So let me just give you an example or an illustration of this, because I think that's the best way to get across what Bumbavrk is talking about. So the way you think about production processes in the Austrian framework is you have to realize that there are what's called original factors of production, and that's labor and land, or what we, you know, you might call natural resources. Okay, so this, your physical labor power that you're sort of endowed with by nature, and then also the goods and the resources that nature gives us directly. All right, so that's what we started out with. There was a time historically when there were no capital goods, and then what people do is they realize if we take our labor power and these natural resources and we produce not direct consumption goods, but we produce capital goods that we then use with more input of natural resources and labor to either yield a consumption good or further capital goods, we end up increasing our physical productivity. Okay, so let's just illustrate that. You can imagine, let's say you're out in the woods and you live in a cottage and there's a stream that's 100 yards away from your cottage. So every day you wanna, I don't know, you wanna cook something, all right? Let's say you wanna take a bath in your house, okay? And you've got the bathtub in there that's fixed in your house, and you don't have running water, right? Because you're out in the woods. And so you wanna get water from the stream that's 100 yards away into your house. So how are you going to do it? Well, Bumbavrk says one way you could do it is you just walk down to the stream and you cup your hands, right? You know, you just cup your hands like this, and you pick up the water and you walk the 100 yards back to your house and then dump it in the bathtub, and you just keep going back and forth. And obviously that's going to be a very inefficient way of doing it, but it's very quick in the sense that, you know, if you, you know, start out with no other materials, you just have your bare hands and you've got that stream that's 100 yards away, and you absolutely positively want to get a few drops of water into your bathtub as quickly as humanly possible, well, what you do is you sprint down to the river, you know, pick up the water in your hands and sprint back. And that's the quickest way you can get a few drops of water into your bathtub. But the point is, if you look at, you know, what's the return? What's the physical amount of water, the volume of water you get per minute of your labor, right? If you count up, well, how many minutes did it take me to walk down to the stream to cup the water and to walk back? And then I take the amount of water in terms of, you know, how many thimblefuls did I put in divided by the number of minutes, and that's what I compute to figure out, you know, what's the product of my labor, how many water droplets per minute. It would be a pretty low number, right? You'd have to put in a lot of minutes in order to fill up that bathtub, but it would be very quick in terms of the initial filling it up, right? Okay, so then Bobrick says there's other alternatives, there's other options at your disposal. Instead of using your labor to directly try to get water and put it in your bathtub, you can take a more indirect, or what Bombaver called a roundabout process. So you could go out and maybe go grab a coconut, right? And if at first you might be saying, well, that's a complete waste of time. I'm trying to get water from the stream into my bathtub. Why am I going and climbing a tree and picking a coconut? That has nothing to do with it. Well, because you're taking a roundabout path, right? And then you go and you get a rock, and you crack open the coconut, and then you hollow it out, and now you've got an empty coconut shell. And then you walk down to the stream and fill the coconut shell up with water and walk back to your house, and then you do that. And you keep walking back and forth, not using your bare hands, but using the coconut shell. Okay, so now in that framework, in that story, the coconut shell that you've turned into a little bowl is now a capital good, right? The coconut originally was a natural resource. It was a gift of nature. But you used your labor to transform it into a capital good, into the bowl, all right? And then notice that it now, that really augments your labor. So when you're walking back and forth to the stream holding that bowl, what's happened is now your labor is far more productive. Now, if you start measuring, you know, how much water is going into my bathtub for every minute of my labor, now the number is much, much bigger than it was when you were using your bare hands. Okay, but the difference is you had to wait longer. Okay, so remember, originally, if the point was I want to get a few drops of water into that tub as quickly as possible, then you just sprint and use your bare hands. But if you can wait a little bit, if the goal instead is to say something like, by the end of, you know, this evening, I want to have as much water in the bathtub as possible. So if you can wait a little bit, well, then it makes much more sense to go and take the roundabout path and climb the tree and hollow out the coconut shell. Okay, so everyone get that? That you're augmenting the physical output of natural resources if you don't directly tackle the ultimate goal, but if you instead adopt a more roundabout process. Right? That's what Bombaverick has in mind. And then, of course, if you have lots of time, if you can, you know, spend many months working on these sort of intermediate projects, well, then you can go and build yourself a shovel. You can dig out a trench from your house to the river and try to direct the water so that it flows into your house and so forth. And you can regulate it with various things and so on. All right. And so you see how if you're willing to spend months investing your labor and creating all sorts of capital goods, then, you know, ultimately when all is said and done, you can have gallons of water flowing in all the time. And then if you did the math and you said, well, gee, now I'm getting, you know, 4 gallons of water per hour, and then you compared it to over that last year when I was building the trench and so on, how much of my labor did I put into it, you can run the numbers and you'll find that the amount of water per unit of my labor is even higher than it was from hollowing out the coconut shell. Okay, but again, the trade-off is you would have to wait much longer for the fruits of that particular process to kick in. Okay, so that's the basic Bombaverkian framework. And Let me now move on to the last slide. And let me just make a few comments here. Callahan's article, I don't really have too many comments on that. The crucial thing there is to realize in the Austrian framework, everything is subjective. Okay, so all of these things have to do with the subjective plans of the acting agents. So in particular, something that's a capital good to one person might be a consumption good to somebody else. And for example, you're in a grocery store walking down the aisle and you see a box of Cheerios on the shelf. To the owner of the store, that's a capital good. That's part of his inventory. That's a means to his end, which is, you know, getting money, and then he's going to go buy stuff with the money, right? So for him, he's not looking at that box of Cheerios as something he's going to eat. To him, that's a component of his business, just like the lights would be. But to you as the consumer, when you grab that box and put it in your cart, now you're buying a consumer good, right? So that same physical thing is a capital good to one person, a consumer good to somebody else. And even for the same person, a capital good can flip and become a consumption good or vice versa, depending on your subjective understanding of how that thing fits in with your plans. So the example I like to use is, if you're a musician sitting on the street corner and you're strumming a guitar, just having a good time, then that's a consumption good to you, right? The guitar gives you direct pleasure just from, you know, playing the melodies and so forth. But people start walking by and they start throwing change at you, and you realize, oh, wait a minute, I can make money with this thing. Now, if you view that guitar not as a way to give you direct happiness because you just like wasting away the hours playing music, now you're looking at it as, this thing's a moneymaker. If I play this thing, people will start throwing me change. And so now that consumption good has turned into a capital good. Okay, as far as DeSoto, again, I said this before, but let me just say again here, this is crucial, all right? For you to understand this week's material, you need to read the DeSoto selection. And in particular, read it for all the definitions, because in these lectures, there's just too much material. I can't cover every little thing. I can't even define all the terms you need to know, whereas the DeSoto excerpts are very comprehensive, and he lays it all out for you there. I don't have the time to do it right now, because I'm already over time by 10 minutes. I had wanted to go over the diagram that shows the different stages of production and like the 100 units of output and so on. I think what we'll do is I'll do that when we come back from the break, because that's not what I'm thinking about. That's really important, but I already got over. So Grayson, if we can just have that on deck after the 15-minute break, that will be the first thing I'll go over, and then I'll turn over to your guys' Q&A. But I really do need to go over that, because there's a ton of information packed into that diagram. Okay, and then as far as the sushi article, I don't really have any particular comments on that, except to say, if you really get into the numbers there of the particular numerical example I gave at the end, I think that really, I struck a pretty good balance between making it complicated enough that you could really see the Austrian story, but yet keeping it simple enough so that it's not completely overwhelming, right? So if you're getting lost in these various examples and you haven't read it yet, try that sushi article and maybe that will make it click for you. Okay, so at this point, let me stop. I went about 11 minutes over, so I think we should take the full 15-minute break so that we can all recharge ourselves. So right now I'm showing 26 after. So if we come back in 15 minutes, what is that? Is that 41? Am I doing the math right? Yeah. So let's come back. We'll start at 41 minutes after the hour. And again, the first thing we'll do is go over that chart from the DeSoto chapter. All right, so and last thing, again, if you've had enough and you want to tune out at this point, that's fine. It's not that you need to see the Q&A, although probably the one exception for tonight is you might want to stick around at least for me talking about that chart. But again, all this stuff is going to be recorded. If you need to go now, that's fine, and you can just maybe check the recording after the fact. Okay, so I'll see everybody at 41 minutes after. And I'll put on some music in the background just so it's not so lonesome for you who are sticking around.